want to briefly just talk a little bit about generic arguments, generic negative argument. What would be some advantages of having a generic argument pre-written as negative that applies to, say, 15, 20 cases in a round? What would be some potential benefits to that? Somebody want to? Yes. Okay. We'll say it narrows negative burden. Narrows the negative burden. Anything else? Okay. So it allows you to debate on ground that you're familiar with. Now, okay, that's actually one I want to hit on a little bit too. This is one of the biggest benefits of this type of approach is because generally, and I think maybe Coach Van said this the other day, what's the biggest benefit of the affirmative team? What is probably like their number one? Why do you want to be affirmative if you get a chance? Yes.
Because you have all the evidence and you know what the debate is going to be about.
Yes, you set the terms for the debate. But if you, as negative, come in with a generic argument, you can help kind of shift the debate ground. You can spin the debate instead of talking about global warming and a carbon tax or cap and trade. You can spin the debate talking about statism, or spin the debate talking about federalism, talking about how the EPA as an agency fails to work, talking about how your impact turns on why global warming is good, something like that. So it allows you to be prepared and be the expert on that little argument area that you might want to bring into the realm. Now, let's talk about a few types of potential generic arguments. What are some good arguments that you can write up as far as argument types? So we have prepared, narrows the burden. I want to put one more down there. We'll leave it there. What are some types of generic arguments that lend themselves to having generic kind of constructions on that? Yes.
Federalism.
Okay, no. I'm talking, and that's good, but I'm talking more about like argument types, like what are some types of arguments that are very well written as generic? Yes.
Disadvantages.
Disadvantages are a good type of generic argument to write. Anything else? Yes, over here.
Solvency.
Yes. Okay. Anything? I'm thinking at least one other big category that works. Now let's think about why disadvantages, for example, are such a good type of generic argument to write up. And that is because disadvantages, if you think about rounds that you've been in as negative, probably a lot of the rounds that you've won on arguments like solvency, arguments like disadvantages. Disadvantages are generally very persuasive to a judge. Disadvantages specifically as a type of argument are an offense. They're an offense tool. You're not on defense defending why the status quo is good or trying to, you know, just mitigate the impact of the affirmative case. You actually have an argument where you can go on offense, and it's a very aggressive type argument. You're showing why their plan is wrong, not why their plan is not going to achieve the type of benefits they think it is, or why the harms in the status quo aren't as bad. Those are both like mitigating types of arguments. So it's a very offensive type of argument. So that's why it's so good. Also, another reason why it's a really good argument is because of the impacts associated with disadvantages a lot of times. And let me just toss some ideas that I have out here for generic disadvantages that you guys could look at writing this year. And these are ideas that maybe you could go back and research on that I've thought about. I think I've written some of these disadvantages, but other ones that are still to be written. Okay, one, and we've talked about federalism. We're not going to go further there. Another one is a business confidence disadvantage. That's a disadvantage that comes up all the time in the NFL. Teams have big files on this. Basically, what you want to say is whenever the government increases regulations in the economy, businesses become skeptical. Businesses lose confidence. Small business owners are substantially negatively impacted, sounds like super debate talk, by regulations. And as a result, they're going to be less likely to make other investments in the economy, like hiring new workers, you know, making, buying new equipment, that kind of thing. It's going to destroy their confidence in the economy. So ultimately, and then you can demonstrate that how confidence in the economy is essential for stimulating growth, whatever. But ultimately, you're basically running that environmental regulations are bad. That's a good argument. Business confidence disadvantage is going to be run a good bit. Another argument that I would kind of suggest, and this is, if anybody can write this argument in their extra time and make it work and make it look really well, this is going to be super bonus points. An argument that I would really like to see a team write that I think will work very well, but somebody just has to sit down and really do some serious research on this, is there's a type of disadvantage called an agency overstretch disadvantage, where basically you say, this is especially, the link for this is if the affirmative team doesn't increase funding or staffing for an agency, you come in and show the EPA is overstaffed, or understaffed, underfunded. And you look at one of their functions that a lot of people don't know about. Who is researching the counterterrorism functions of the EPA? Over here, we have a little bit over here. Yeah. The EPA actually is involved in some counterterrorism functions. So the way the disadvantage would work would be that what would potentially happen is in order for the EPA to implement the affirmative team's plan, they would potentially pull people out of that division or another division and that can leave us more vulnerable to a terrorist attack. If they have people in another type of enforcement, say nuclear, I don't know if they're involved in regulating nuclear power or looking at any type of safety there, but you could potentially pull them off of that and it could increase the risk of an accident in another area. So the agency would be overstretched and that could create issues. And, well, the way to make that even a better disadvantage is to say that they're going to, and we actually had a really good internal link card on this that we gave a couple of our teams that says that the CIS will pull, the CIS is overloaded, they pull workers off from the border, from border enforcement into an administrative task. So literally, we take people off the border and it makes it more likely that whatever illegal immigrants or terrorists come into the U.S. So yeah, that would be a good example of that. So that's another one. Now this is another disadvantage that it's called an environmental movements, disadvantage. I think if you look at it, you can see kind of a shell of it on one of those websites with free evidence that I was talking about. But it's kind of a real tricky disadvantage and it would work something like this. Basically, you want to argue that environmental movements like Greenpeace, Sierra Club, things like that are essential to procuring environmental reform. If you think about key bans and stuff that have been instituted in the past against DDT or something like that, some of these environmental groups have been very influential in getting those instituted. So basically, strong environmental groups are very important. The link comes in when the affirmative takes a very high-profile environmental issue off the table. For example, let's talk about polar bears. Environmental groups can raise tons of money on encouraging people to try to, donate to save the polar bear, something like that. That's a big, they get a lot of publicity for that kind of thing. So if the affirmative team takes the polar bears off the agenda by protecting them or something like that, and they no longer become an issue that an environmental group can use in a fundraising or an expansion type campaign, then it ultimately weakens the environmental groups. And if you can show that the environmental groups are necessary to produce some sort of other reform, like whatever, preventing global warming or anything like that, and that they need this kind of funding from these other high profile issues, maybe ultimately will be resulting in net environmental harm by weakening the environmental movement. So that's kind of that disadvantage has been constructed in the past. I've seen old versions of it, but if you can put that in recent evidence, that's really good. Another thing that's kind of interesting, there's a book, and I cannot think of the professor who published this, but it was originally published in the 1970s, and it's been republished in 2008. If you Google Hollow Hope, it talks about why it's futile to use courts to implement environmental policy, how a lot of times the courts are unable to force the environmental regulatory agencies to do what they want them to do. And also you can look at how the environmental regulatory agencies, even if you give them, if Congress tells them to do this, how they sometimes don't do it or fail to do it, something like that. Do Hollow Hope. Anybody Google that and looked Hollow Hope, and maybe on Google Books or something like that?
Gerald N. Rosenberg?
I think that may be the name. Let me see the book. Pretty sure that's the book. Gerald N. Rosenberg. If you look up his name, he has some good stuff to say on that. That is a pretty big deal. Well, there's a lot of disadvantages that you can link into things like oil dependence. A lot of apps will be reducing dependence on foreign oil. I know that I've written this disadvantage back about 5 years ago where you argue that the Saudi government is dependent on oil revenues and the only way that they can stay in power is by buying off opposition with oil revenues. If we reduce their oil revenues, that could result in an Islamic State takeover in Saudi Arabia. So that could be a pretty good disadvantage. There's also some things related to the Caspian region about how oil is bringing stability to the Caspian basin and potentially taking that out could result in problems there. So anyway, lots of great disadvantages. You think about all those disadvantages, some of those have some pretty good impacts. If you can pull one of those in a round and really effectively argue it against the other team's case, that can really work well. Now, for bonus here, and this will conclude what I'm going to want to say about generic arguments here, somebody tell me a weakness about these type of arguments. What is the weakness? Why are they sometimes very weak? I don't know who had their hand up first, but Elaine, what do you think?
The non-unique.
No, that wasn't so much what I was thinking. Anybody else have something else over here? Yes, Hannah.
If you take out the link.
Yes, sometimes the links here are very suspect and very weak. So oftentimes teams will just think, oh, we have this file, let's pull our generic file and try to get it to link into the other team's case, and sometimes that link is just not there. They're trying to pull it and stretch it and make it there. So that's kind of the weakness that you go after on these things for the links. Okay, enough of that. Let's move right into talking a little bit about negative briefing here. Now, as you can see, here's some serious researchers. Here's their evidence right here. This is a real picture. I don't think this is NCFCA, but actually, how many tubs? They have 8 tubs. I've seen some NCFCA teams with 6 tubs before. So that's pretty impressive. Okay, so what's a negative brief? And we've talked about this in part, but I want to make 3 points about what a negative brief is. A negative brief is a collection of evidence cards against a case. The key here is that it's of evidence. And I think when we look at the what is not a negative brief, this will come up. But one of the things that I said last night, and I want to say again here, is I really counsel against putting little opinion summaries or analysis or conclusions or impacts after evidence cards, because that can often result in distorting the intent of those cards and other people look at those, or maybe even getting confused with the actual evidence text after that brief goes through several hands. So it's a collection of evidence, not necessarily, you know, your opinion or good arguments. You can just think of arguments somewhere else. Flexible outline. A negative brief should never be like a speech that you bring into a round and you're going to read this from top to bottom and make these arguments from top to bottom. You should have multiple subcategories of arguments in negative brief, multiple solvency presses, multiple significance presses, and be able to adapt those to the round and to the affirmative case. Because, for example, we have a big case on, say, offshore drilling. Probably the teams will implement offshore drilling somewhat the same way, but there'll be little variations in the case and the harms and the advantages that you'll need to be able to adapt to in the round. And that's why having an outline looking at multiple scenarios is very beneficial. And finally, it's the collective opinion of others, not necessarily of what you think, but what others think about it. So what is it not? Kind of the flip side here. It's not a speech. It's not a rigid document dictating what you should argue, and it's not your opinion or ideas expressed in words. Again, sometimes we don't have evidence as debaters and we have to make logical arguments, but that's not what a negative brief is at all. It's about evidence. And the point about the speech is really important. You know, it's really important that, and I think that this makes much stronger speakers. A speaker who can speak impromptu or extemporaneously is much more persuasive and connects much better to the judge than if you're actually giving a manuscript speech. And that's kind of, interestingly enough, how the 1A a lot of times doesn't get quite as good as speaker points, because they have a pre-delivered speech and the judges are like, oh, you know, this is the 1AC, of course they should, you know it, that kind of thing. So really speaking extemporaneously with like an impromptu speech is very, is more persuasive generally. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit, about a good card. What makes a good, card, what makes a good piece of evidence? Because ultimately briefs are made out of evidence cards. And I want to make four big takeaway points here. It's short, and we're actually going to be doing a exercise / workshop on that particular point. Yes, where I am going to be asking you to go through a short article and find good cards that meet these four qualifications. And another thing, let me talk about something else that I didn't think about to put on the lecture, but that I want to talk about: writing tags, evidence tags, because I've been working with a couple people on those. Just kind of some tips on how to tag evidence and how you should write those tags. Because the tags are really important, because technically that's what you're reading right before you read the evidence. So the judge is probably writing on the flow. The judge doesn't listen to the evidence and think, oh boy, let's write this evidence down word for word. You give the tag, the judge writes the tag down, that's what goes on the flow, that's what the judge thinks your evidence means. So if you don't have strongly worded tags, guess what? Your evidence just took a massive hit, whether it's really good or not. So some ideas with tags. One, really do not overburden those tags with adjectives at all. If you can prevent adjectives, fewer adjectives, the better. The judge isn't going to write the adjectives down generally. He's going to write down the key concepts, the nouns, the subjects, the direct objects, those kind of things. Try to reduce the adjectives. Another thing, the tag really shouldn't probably not be more than like a sentence, one line. If it cannot fit on one line on like a 10-space Word document, it's probably too long. So it probably needs to be one line. Another thing, if you can mention numbers and specifics in the tag, that's good too. I've seen a lot of people who tag evidence, even in this group, very generally. Like they'll take a piece of evidence that says, the U.S. economy will lose thousands of jobs. The evidence says the U.S. economy will lose thousands of jobs if we don't implement nuclear power today. And then that'll be tagged, the U.S. economy hurt by not implementing nuclear power. That's an okay tag, but if you put in thousands of jobs actually in the tag, that is much more likely to go on the judge's flow, and that is much better as a statistic than just a broad kind of summary statement on that. So numbers are good to put in the tags. Leave out adjectives, one line. And also, who wants to explain what power tagging is? Let's talk a little bit about power tagging, because that's actually a form of unethical evidence. But let's go ahead and discuss it now. What's a power tagged card? Yes.
I'm not for sure, but power tagging is where you, like,
more strongly word something in the evidence than it's actually worded.
Right. Generally, it's and this is a form of actual evidence falsification. Not, it's a less serious form. There are various scales of falsification. This is probably on the less serious side, but technically, it's a form of evidence falsification. Definitely an evidence ethics problem, where you have a tag that says, you know, like, that says one thing. It's very strongly worded, like, if we don't pass our plan tomorrow, you know, we'll have global extinction within 3 weeks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the card might say, some experts have opinion that there is a possibility that if the affirmative plan does not pass in a reasonable period of time, that global extinction is one of the possibilities that we may face. A lot more qualified than that. And making a statement without acknowledging those qualifications can result in power tagged evidence. Oftentimes, power tagged evidence is also a tag that has very little to do with actually what the card says. So you want to make sure that the tag mirrors what the evidence is actually saying. Because again, and the reason that's an abusive issue is because, like I said, since the judge generally only writes the tags down on the flow, that's what you're portraying the evidence as. So you're really misrepresenting the evidence if you put a tag like that down. So anyway, enough for tags. Let's talk a little bit about the four characteristics of evidence. Short and concise, qualified, gives warrants, and is almost always recent. Short and concise, number one. What I'm saying is, I think this evidence, if you have a piece of evidence that lasts longer than 45 seconds, that's probably too long. You cannot have really long pieces of evidence. The evidence, the judge doesn't want to hear evidence during the entire round. The judge wants to hear your analysis of the evidence. They didn't come here to read a book, they came to the round to hear you speak and to hear you communicate. So whereas the evidence is essential to verifying some of the claims that we make as debaters, ultimately, you need to be able to state the evidence, read the evidence card, your facts should clearly be stated in there, then you should be able to explain that to the judge, break it down to the judge, impact to the judge how it relates to the round. And that's not adding to the evidence, you should be, again, explaining the evidence, but ultimately, you don't want to spend a round reading a massively long card. Another point, I say if it's over 7 sentences, that's probably too long, depending, sometimes less, sometimes more, some people write very long sentences. And another tip here, if you have a really long card, make it multiple cards, make 2 cards. And again, you can have tags broken in there that can clearly delineate it a little bit there too. And I think this is, let me see if I have another slide here. So, okay, I'll keep it here. Use underlines to get material. We've talked about that. That's a good way to shorten stuff up sometimes. And why short? 3 points there. You're more interesting than the evidence. Judges have short attention spans. I've seen judges that I have been judging me in debate rounds who literally, they kind of lost track of what the evidence was saying after we got through like the 10th sentence, you know? So it's not short. The judge may just zone out.
I've seen that happen to debaters.
Debaters may sometimes do that too. They forget what it says by the time they're through. So in cards, and this is another point that I want to make. Cards should make a single point. If you have a card that is saying like it harms the economy, harms the environment, harms national security, and it has a paragraph analyzing all of that. That really needs to be 3 cards. Break each card into, if you can, a single fault. Now, we've had a discussion about this. Why do you have a card that just real briefly says global warming harms the economy, harms the environment, and harms national security, and that's all it says? Well, that pretty much has to be 1 card. You can't go through and split that up. But especially if you have 3 developed faults in a card, that's way too many. Only 1 really developed fault in a card. So short and concise. And be thinking about that when we're going to be doing some carding here in this exercise in a minute. Okay, another point. Your evidence needs to be qualified. And under this, who is the measure of qualified in the round? Who measures whether the evidence is qualified? Somebody who haven't called on for a while. Let's see here. I've called on you today. Lael. Do you want to tell me why this is important? Why? Who determines whether evidence is qualified in a round?
Make a judgment call on whether or not your source is credible. So,
but who in the round determines what qualified evidence is?
The judge.
Who said that? Okay, yes, that's right. Here you go. Good job. Yes, the judge. The judge determines what's qualified. If the judge doesn't think your evidence is qualified, it doesn't matter whether you have Mr. PhD from Harvard who has every single degree under his name and has written 35 peer-reviewed articles and is the president of 2 institutions. If the judge doesn't find that persuasive, it doesn't matter. So it's very important, and that's one of the reasons why we don't quote Wikipedia. If I was in a round and you wanted to quote something from Wikipedia, I might be okay with that. But the majority of judges aren't going to necessarily like that.
Are you good
for some things? No.
Oh, dang it.
Too bad. So anyway, that's a point there. And also you need to be able to relate to the judge what qualified is. The judge may not, if you say this person has a published a peer-reviewed journal article, the judge may not necessarily see that as a qualification. So it depends. Or the judge may not know what a certain institution is. They may not know what, trying to think of a kind of, the American Enterprise Institute is. They may have never heard of that before. Whereas a debater has heard about that. They know what The Economist is, for example. A judge may not know that. So you got to relate that to the judge. Okay. Generally, degrees are very persuasive. If the person is a professor or a PhD, that's kind of important. Now, let me just say something here. If somebody is a professor, does that mean they're a PhD? No, it doesn't. And some debaters automatically assume that professors have PhDs and add that into their credentials. So just bear that in mind, too. Seen that happen. What degrees does this person have? Where did this person go to school? Where has this person been published? Has this person ever lectured? That's another very credible thing, too. Sometimes you have even like journalists who may have lectured on a particular subject that can add a good bit of credibility to them as well because it associates them with a particular institution. And sometimes the organization is more credible than the author. And in that case, you should quote the organization. If it comes from Mr. John Joe, who is a recent graduate of Purdunk University, but he wrote for the Heritage Foundation, you probably want to quote that Heritage Foundation 2009. And, you know, you have in the citation that it was from Purdunk Joe, but just have all that those components in the citation, but don't necessarily quote Purdunk Joe. I'm kind of interested this year. I almost think the ACLU, though generally a good source, they do a ton of research. Probably not the best for this league, for example. So again, that goes back to what would the judge see as qualified. The same may apply with an organization such as Greenpeace. And again, even though you may have to think about that, we have evidence from Greenpeace, the judge necessarily going to think that's qualified in our league and in our circles. And you have to, again, adapt your presentation to the judge. And that includes adapting what evidence you're going to use. So point two, qualified. Point three, and we've talked a little bit about this. Now, hopefully we sort of get this right here. And there's a bonus. There's kind of an, I guess, textbook answer here. And then there's an answer that I'll accept for variation. So we have a piece of evidence here from Dr. Cornell Brown, PhD in political science, Global Warming, Harvard-Yale Journal, 2009, quote, global warming is an irrefutable fact. We'll add that in there. And then we have another piece of evidence from Jane Doe, 2009, Washington Times. Global warming is supported by the temperature trends from the World Meteorological Organization, which show a consistent warming trend over 150 years. This is all fabricated, so don't quote this or anything. In addition, natural sources of data such as ice cores and tree rings support the reality of global warming. Which one of these pieces of evidence is a stronger piece of evidence?
Second.
Why is it a stronger piece of evidence? The first. Who says the first? How many people say the second? Say the second, raise your hand. Okay, hands down. People that say the first, raise your hand. Okay, now, there's two answers on this, but somebody who can explain this to me a little bit, your side, again, this is debatable, but the point I'm trying to make here is there, first of all, the point I'm trying to make under this, what's the answer, do you think?
That a PhD is, that you're trying to make the point that longer is not always better. Because the guy has the PhD in political science.
No. Okay. We have lots of hands, lots of opinions on this. Let's go to somebody who haven't tried. Man, all the same people keep raising their hands here. Cameron, what do you think? Which one of these pieces of evidence is a better piece of evidence? A or B?
I'd say the second one.
Why?
I can't read it.
Okay. Somebody want to expand on that? Okay. Let's see here. Tell me your name right there.
Sarah,
what do you think, Sarah?
I took the first one because he's a PhD in political science from Harvard.
He's a PhD from political science from Harvard. Okay. Okay, what do you think, Hannah?
I think the point you're trying to make is that warrants are important, which is why you have... That's the point you're trying to make.
Right.
I mean,
you're okay, yeah. Now... Now, I'll accept an argument on the first one. Why is the first one potentially more credible? Somebody, yes.
It's more digestible.
And
did you say more credible?
Why is it more credible? Yes. Somebody want to make an argument for that? Yes.
Because he knows what he's talking about.
Okay, and sort of right, yeah, okay.
But he's a PhD in political science. Yeah. He's a qualification.
That's true. That's another tester. But let's assume this guy just has, let's change the guy's credentials, say he has a PhD in meteorological science. That's a good point, because technically that's another big disclaimer here. I forgot another flaw that I wrote in my evidence there. So this guy really is not the expert you think he is. At all. But let's assume he's a PhD in meteorological science. And that's I actually was like, yeah, there's two arguments here, but yeah, I actually saved myself by putting PhD in political science, just forgot it. Okay, so it's PhD in meteorological science. What's the ramifications for that? We talk about warrants. We want evidence that has a warrant. Can having, how, do we have warrants in this card?
Yeah.
What's the warrant? Probably, what's, yeah.
It's talking about the WMO, which...
Is there a warrant in this card? Is there a warrant in A?
Oh, no.
Is there a warrant in A?
No.
Who thinks there's a warrant in A? What do you think, Shane?
I think that it's not necessarily a warrant in written words, but I think it is because the expert...
It's an implicit warrant. Exactly. Yes, that's the point. That's the point. Very good. Yes, there is an implicit warrant in this card that because this guy is an expert and knows what he's talking about, that's right. That's the only warrant. It's going up against these three warrants right here. But because this guy's an expert, it's right. Now, what I would challenge for this card is I would ask, why does this guy, how did this guy draw his conclusion? That kind of thing. But you have to understand that even in cards like this, if they come from a qualified source, there is an implicit warrant, and that's what you're going up against. But you got to understand, That's the issue with this evidence. That's how you have to combat it. That's the real issue in the round, in the building. Okay, we have some hands on that. Sarah, what do you think?
I just have a question. The second one almost looks like this Jane Doe is actually quoting someone. So when I saw the quotes, I actually thought that he was quoting someone who he was talking about.
No, nobody's name is really in there. This is just a regular quote. Jane Doe's done her research. She has good reasons why that's true. Now, for example, but let's evaluate the relative strength of these warrants. In my opinion here, even assuming Dr. Cornell Brown has a PhD in meteorological science, I think this is a stronger card because it has multiple reasons. Dr. PhD is entitled to whatever opinion he wants to, but unless he actually substantiates those in the long run, when we have an actual card that lists reasons stacked up against a PhD and he can't provide any further justification, he's just making a conclusion until he shows us. The reason he's credible as an expert is because he should know what he's talking about. This card doesn't necessarily show that context necessarily. So I would say, hey, you know, Dr. PhD can say whatever, but boy, what does he say about the tree rings? What does he say about the meteorological, irrefutable meteorological warming record from the World Meteorological Organization? What about the ice cores? He hasn't addressed these things. How do these fit into his analysis? Those things cause his conclusion to be suspect. And you can use a piece of evidence like that way. Okay, yes?
I was just going to say, it depends on who your audience is. If you're having an audience like us, the second piece would be better because... Like, we know what it is, but to a judge, like a community judge, a lot of times the first time one
would be. See, I might disagree with you on that, because I believe that as a debater, this is not above the community judge's comprehension level. This is something that you should explain to the community judge that what's going on here. Just because this person has a PhD, maybe the community judge might think that's better, but I think from a debate perspective, it is easy, even with a person who is not knowledgeable about debate, to make arguments and say, just like in an everyday life, that, you know, hey, we actually have three legitimate reasons here why that this guy doesn't seem to be factoring into his opinion that need to be addressed. And that's an argument that I think a community judge is at. The community judges can understand that. That makes common sense. This is not, you know, debate techno talk that we're talking here. This is, I think, fairly common that you need to have reasons behind some of these things. Sarah, do you still have something?
Yeah. If you're using these two cards together, this is like what I would do personally is I would take the first one and use it as a quote and opening so that the judge catches that short little sentence that sticks in their mind. Then I would use the second one to expand and explain.
And that's a good point as well. And I'll give a piece of candy for that, even though we generally don't give for questions, but good job. Yeah, the strongest combination here would be both of these. Mm-hmm. Say, read our PhD expert, and this is all we can get from him, and he doesn't have any better quote, whatever, we have that. And then we have this quote, we kind of have the best of both worlds here in our scenario. So that's the best thing to do, for sure. But yeah, when we have to weigh one against the other, you know, that's the deal here. So, okay, let's check this out. If they both said the same thing, in this case, they contradict. But anyway, okay,
good point.
Okay, warrants. What are some warrants? We've tried to emphasize warrants a little bit this week. What are some things that can count as warrants that you want to try to look for in evidence? Studies generally are considered warrants. And I think we've talked about this. This is later on down the list. Have we talked about if something is empirically derived, what that means? Anybody remember that?
I mean, I know what it is.
Okay, what is it?
An empirical, like something that's an empiric or an empirical piece of evidence is an example.
Mm.
So something that is like...
Right, maybe even multiple examples would be the best thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's based on experience.
Yeah.
It's based on things that we know to be true based on experience. And that's legitimate as well. It's not theoretical. We can say, hey, we have this case study, and this case study, where it's happened in the past to back it up. It's not, we believe that theoretically when we enter into this situation, X will occur. It's like, we have seen this occur when this has happened 30 times in the past. Statistics, good warrants, reasoning, that kind of thing. And no matter how qualified someone is, what I make down here is they just can't go around making statements. They need, even the PhD from Harvard needs to be able to back up what he's saying with some kind of statement. Some kind of reasoning or study or logic behind that. Okay, enough of warrants, I think, here. And I think we're, let's see here. Okay. And just another example here, talking about this a little bit. We have a study, a real brief example here. This is actually a little bit better card than the last card. Cato Taylor, 2009, Cap and Trade is from Hell. Article entitled, Cap and Trade Will Collapse the Economy and Cause the Loss of 3 Million Jobs. That's a statistic. The loss of 3 million jobs. The loss of 3 million jobs. Cap and Trade Will Collapse the Economy and Cause the Loss of 3 Million Jobs. How could you tell this evidence was falsified?
There's a typo in it.
Yes, there's a typo in it. Another good point there. Okay. We have another card, though, here. Cap and trade will collapse the economy by raising energy prices 15% according to a study by McKinsey Consulting. Higher energy prices will raise the price for all consumer goods. Since nearly everything is transported by truck, higher prices in this tight economy mean people buy less, and most economists agree that consumer spending is a bad one of our economy. This actually explains the reasoning behind how these jobs are lost instead of just stating the jobs are going to be lost. And again, that's important as well. So that provides a warrant. The first one is a pretty good piece of evidence because it has a statistic, but again, it doesn't necessarily provide a warrant explaining how those jobs actually are lost. The reasoning behind it. Okay, the last point here, recency. My rule of thumb is pretty much last 3 years. If it's longer than the last 3 years, generally you don't use it in policy debate. There are two exceptions, big exceptions, for philosophical type arguments. That's the LD people can probably, that's why we don't have so much of a big deal with dates in LD, because you guys are debating philosophical things. So when we're debating philosophical things, those are allegedly timeless attributes, right? I don't think much of LD, but no. I'm sure that's true. We have timeless attributes, timeless concepts here. And that's what maybe things like critiques, which generally are based on philosophy and definitions, are kind of, can be the same way. Again, definitions, if you define something from 1890, that could be a problem. And I've seen that occur in the debate round too. Hannah.
What about court cases? Is that a rule?
And that could be another exception, assuming it's the controlling case.
As long as it's the controlling case.
Right. If it's not the most recent precedent, then that's not good. Okay. Inherency. Generally, your inherency needs to be within the last year. Again, inherency is the most date-sensitive evidence, time-sensitive evidence, and where you really need to pay attention on the date. And also, as we'll hit with evidence ethics again, be aware of updated and access. That's what Coach Mance made a huge deal about last night. Some people, you know, if the evidence has updated or access, you got to read that when you read the quote. You cannot ignore that. And some debaters will, you know, recycle evidence with that type of terminology, as Coach Vance talked about last night. Let's see here. Yeah, okay. One more slide, then we'll do an exercise and talk about a little bit more about actually the process of writing briefs. Okay, how to improve cards. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points. Look up credentials. I've had this, seen lots of people with us so far, where they will settle for something like, you know, policy analyst at NCPA. Maybe that's what the article said. Maybe if you look at the bottom of the article, it said the person was a policy analyst at the NCPA. So their credentials were right there, right? Well, not necessarily. You might want to dig a little bit deeper to see who this person actually is. And that can really make your evidence a lot stronger. I made my evidence, this is actually pretty funny. When I was, my last year in high school, I really applied this principle. I literally looked up all my sources. So the number of PhDs that I had is on my evidence that we were reading in rounds was pretty high. Now, I kind of bet that teams that were running similar cases had probably about the same ratio, just they didn't look their people up. And actually, one of my good buddies wrote a massive source indictment on why a PhD was not a credible source. That was kind of interesting. So I don't think he ever ran it, but he really liked writing it. So, and he just kind of sent it to me as an FYI. He had like, it was like a 10-page brief. I'm not kidding. He kind of was obsessed with that. Okay, use short, this is another way. Look at this. Okay, we've talked about this. This is a big, hopefully this is a principle you take away from debate camp. Do not be lazy with your research. Do not settle for a secondary source. If, you know, in one of these news articles, if you can see a quick little quote, figure out where that came from, get the original text. The original is always more credible. The people who are writing it are more credible, more likely to be a professor or something like that than the actual news article. So that's something we've had again and again. Shorten your cards up with underlines don't take out of context, but you can write stronger cards because a lot of the information in the card is not necessarily relevant, so only do relevant things. And again, we've talked about how some of these keywords can improve, get good evidence, talked about the file type tip, and statistics are a very powerful and persuasive source of evidence. They're also a good way to search for evidence as well, using keywords like million, billion, that kind of thing. Okay, now we're going to an exercise.